You know, it's unfortunate that I got a guy like Mike Conley who in his whole career has got zero technical fouls and just cannot seem to get the proper respect from the officials that he deserves. It was a very poorly officiated basketball game. Zach Randolph, the most rugged guy in the game, had zero free throws, but somehow Kawhi Leonard had 19 free throws. First half, we shot 19 shots in the paint, and we had 6 free throws. They shot 11 times in the paint, and they had 23 free throws. I'm not a numbers guy, but that doesn't seem to add up. Overall, 35 times we shot the ball in the paint. We had 15 free throws for the game. They shot 18 times in the paint and had 32 free throws. Kawhi shot more free throws than our whole team. Explain it to me. We don't get the respect that these guys deserve because Mike Conley doesn't go crazy. He has class, and he just plays the game. But I'm not going to let them treat us that way. You know, I know Pop's got pedigree, and I'm a young rookie, but they're not going to rook us. That's unacceptable. That was unprofessional. My guys dug in that game and earned the right to be in that game, and they did not even give us a chance.
All right, thank you.
Take that for data.
Well, that was David Fizdale after the Grizz suffered a 96-82 loss to the Spurs. We'll get to that game in a little bit, but thought we would start you with the quote of the day. Also got to do Cavs Pacers. That's where we'll begin with. Then lots of news that's piled up as well. We'll close the show with that. We are brought to you today by our friends at SeatGeek. Use that CapSpace code to get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. And blinds.com. For a limited time, you'll get 20% off everything at blinds.com when you use that familiar promo code CAPSPACE. All right, Danny, so let's get started with this Cavs Pacers game. It was really a very similar game to the previous one, except that Indiana wasn't quite able to get close enough down the end. Cleveland continued to score really well. Indiana scored really well as also, but just not quite as well as Cleveland did. And it ended up with another somewhat frustrating loss for Indiana. But, you know, it's clear to me that despite everything that Paul George is doing and Jeff Teague as well had a really nice game tonight, that, you know, their defense just can't be good enough against this Cavs team to really threaten them, I don't think.
I thought it was interesting that in the last 6 minutes, about the line where I drew it, I thought that Cleveland was taking harder shots than Indiana. And it was striking because that was just not true for most of the game. You know, the Cleveland was getting easier shots, and a moment that really stuck with me was in this, I think it was in the early second quarter. Indiana scored on 5 consecutive trips down the floor. I think one of those was off an offensive rebound, and they only made up 1 point because Cleveland got a series of threes and also got to the free throw line, I think at least twice. And so that kind of put the series in stark relief for me that while the Pacers are incredibly talented, while they can do a lot right, it's going to be hard for them to put it all together.
Yeah, I think your comment before the series that this might be a series that takes a lot out of Cleveland, or I don't know if you quite said this, but to me just continues to expose what some of their weaknesses are as a team, especially defensively. And also you could even look at late game offense a little bit. They've been fantastic in the clutch. Obviously they're a good clutch team last year as well. They're pretty clutch when they came back from down 3-1 in game 7 against the Warriors and all that. But Cleveland does run some pretty simple stuff down the stretch, and they have actually struggled to score in the last 6 minutes of both of these games because it's just pretty much 3-1 pick and roll or 1-3 pick and roll every time. And especially if they have Thompson on the floor, that's something where you can bring, if you have a good rim protecting center, you can bring him over and kind of muck those actions up a little bit. Paul George was fantastic in this one. Again, 32 points, 10 of 20 from the field, hit 4 of his 10 3-point attempts as well, 7 assists, 8 rebounds, leading the team in all 3 of those categories. But he did get some good support in this one. Thaddeus Young, 16 points, 7-11, 6 steals. He had some great help defense at times. Turner did have 3 blocks, although he was 3 out of 10 for 6 points, which is pretty ugly. And then Teague, who we had talked about, looked a little bit slow in the first game, broke out 23 points on only 12 shot attempts, 2 of 3 on threes. Very impressive game for him, although he only had 4 assists. Did Teague look faster to you in this one?
A little bit, but it's also not a surprise that Jeff Teague and Kyrie Irving can produce offensively against each other.
No, that's true. Although Teague is not the greatest defender, but Irving is on a whole other level where his demerits defensively. I mean, Teague, at least he can switch onto LeBron and he'll at least try. You know, he has some limitations to be sure, but Kyrie, other than maybe like one steal that he had in an isolation, just does not try at all. I mean, that was the other takeaway that I had. I mean, just in the first quarter alone, doing the Twitter NBA show, you know, as I'm watching the game, I'll call out whenever I see some bad defense. And yeah, I'm probably predisposed to see it more from Kyrie just because I already believe that he's a poor defender. But there were probably like 6, 7, or 8 just miserable efforts by him in the first quarter alone. And every pick and roll that he's in results in a switch, whether it's intentional or not, because he just doesn't get over the screen and the big just has to step up on his guy. And whether that's part of the scheme now, if it is part of the scheme, it's part of the scheme because they just know he's not going to get over the screen. So, you know, you better just switch it anyway. But you know what? Kyrie Irving had 37 points on 24 shooting possessions, 27 shooting possessions in this one. So, you know, he's still pretty good.
Yeah, you don't want to have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You think that he can improve, and he has had some better defensive performances than he did today. But if that's the trade-off, you live with it every single time, because even though the Cavs don't need Kyrie in the way that some other teams would just because of LeBron James, having him is such a luxury for this team and helps make their offense really sing.
Yeah, and really, it was just a monster effort overall from the big three. Not one of James's better games, actually, at least on offense due to his 8 turnovers. He was still 25 points, 11 to 20 from the field, missing his free throws, still missed half of his free throws in this one, but 4 steals, 4 blocks for James. He was really the only one playing any defense for Cleveland other than Amon Shumpert, who we'll get to a little bit. He came in for J.R. Smith, who went down shortly before halftime with a hamstring. And then Kevin Love, 7 shot attempts. 27 points, 3 of 4 on three-pointers, 12 of 12 from the foul line. And, you know, I'd love to say how Kevin Love is just this unbelievable player and what a performance. And there were some aspects of it that were great. The three-point shooting, for sure. His quick release is a huge problem for traditional bigs to match up with. And then, you know, he went into the post on Lance Stephenson. And, you know, Stephenson had a couple legitimate fouls. Love also did a great job posting, and LeBron James threw 2 just unbelievable passes just over the top to affronted Love for fouls or buckets. All that was great. But Love, again, just getting away with complete murder with that off arm. He's allowed to just like slam into guys with it and knock them backwards. He also did the play where he used his off arm, you know, I mean, a chicken winged away from his body, and then just took the off arm without it even touching the ball up through Lance Stephenson's arm and got a foul call on that one. I mean, they're just, I'll say that in those particular instances and overall here, I think the Pacers got a pretty rough whistle in this one.
Yeah, I have no opposition to that statement at all. I thought that there were some times where the refs just, I think they just need to be more aware of it. And maybe that's the type of thing that's worth a coach getting a fine early in a series, just so the refs start looking at it a little bit more, because it is easier sometimes to see on television, especially with the way that we're looking for it. But it's not that crafty that it's hard to see.
Well, David Fizdale would certainly agree with you, Danny. I will say that, although I don't think that McMillan has done that great of a coaching job, that he overall, that their connectivity and their communication on defense has left a lot to be desired. They blew a lot of switches in this game, blew a lot of pick and roll coverages. The most salient one was CJ Miles and Lance Stephenson. Anytime they came together on any sort of screening action, they blew it. Most memorably, when LeBron came off a screen, Miles picked him up, and then with Stephenson not even close to in front of him, Miles just started running towards Kyle Korver, and LeBron just took one step to the basket and dunked it. I mean, I don't care if Kyle Korver is wide open for a three. If LeBron is 10 feet from the basket and you're the only thing between him and the basket, like, you damn well better stay there. And he just ran to Korver at the three-point line and gave up a dunk. I don't know who Monte Ellis was on the backside. Like, he wasn't going to help out. So despite some of those really ugly plays, I thought McMillan did well. I thought he was smart to give Glenn Robinson the third a look, who's coming off that calf injury. I thought that not playing Aaron Brooks at all was a smart move. He used Ellis more as a backup point guard. I thought that was pretty good. He used Thaddeus Young to guard LeBron James more. It wasn't Paul George guarding James all the time. He tried to put George even on Irving, and that's what led to Love posting up on Stevenson as much as he did. Some were critical that he should have gotten Stevenson off of Love, because there are basically like four possessions in a row where Love either got fouled or scored on Stevenson. But, you know, that was the strategy, and I think they, you know, probably could have executed that a little bit better. I didn't mind that strategy. It was just, you know, Stevenson had to defend a little bit better without fouling, and the refs had to not make bad calls. So I thought he did reasonably well there. Didn't really have many answers to get Miles Turner open, which is something we should talk about. I mean, that's maybe something to hit on now, is like why Miles Turner was criticized by Paul George after the game. You know, why wasn't he able to be effective with shooting only 3 out of 10?
I think that given how many ball dominant guys they have, and I'm not saying Turner needs the ball in his hands more. We talked about that a little bit after game one. I think that it's hard for him to find an equilibrium in this series, and something they should consider trying just to maybe to activate him is to see if it works against Channing Frye, just to give him some post touches and just see if it can get him more involved. I don't think it's the answer. I don't think it's the solution to some of their problems. And Lance Stephenson has actually did a nice job scoring on that second unit in some of the second quarter stretch, but he's just had trouble finding his footing, and he was better in game one than game two, which is concerning. Not this massive like freak out moment or anything like that, but I just see him just a little bit out of sorts. LeBron had that great help block on him late, but that wasn't representative to me, but it was notable.
It was a little representative to me because he shot 1 out of 5 in the restricted area, and
that's a good point.
All of those plays, and that one obviously, you know, that's a tough finish, but Turner's a little bit soft, actually, to be, if we're being honest, and he's not gonna go through contact. It's a very low free throw rate for a center. He can get up and finish some dunks when he's got some space, but when he gets the ball and he's really challenged on the pick and roll, contested finishes are not really his forte. He doesn't really have a ton of touch if it's not a dunk or around the rim. You know, not really a great guy to go and finish off of 1 foot on the pick and roll. And with the Cavs bringing help over, the way they defended the pick and roll in this one, which they got to more down the end of game one as well, but did it pretty much exclusively here, was on those side pick and rolls, rather than trying to force him to the baseline like a lot of teams do, or switch it, they would even just defend it with the big man coming way up, even though they let the guy get middle. And then if they threw it to the roll man, they would bring a help guy over, usually LeBron James. And that's not something that's usually going to work when you have a team with a lot of spacing. But that does not describe the Indiana Pacers. And the help defense was effective on Turner. And then when they would switch on Turner, if he tried to get into the post, he's not really that physical down low. And when they're fronting him, again, no spacing to prevent the backside from coming over and preventing the pass into the post. I do think they could get some looks for Turner when he's in the game, and when Tristan Thompson isn't, Turner likes to just go for more of his turnaround jumper. He's not strong enough to back down in a position, but you know, it could be something to get him a little bit more engaged, as you mentioned. But I don't think that this is a series where he's necessarily going to dominate offensively. And they're taking away his pick and pop game by switching a lot of stuff on the high pick and roll, and then the side pick and roll, as we mentioned, they're bringing another guy over to help.
Are you concerned at all about Cleveland having 19 assists on 42 made baskets?
Well, 42 made baskets is pretty good. And when you look at
Kyrie Irving dominating in ISO circumstances for stretches of this game certainly makes you feel better about it.
Yeah, I mean, when Kyrie really goes off, not many of his buckets are going to be assisted. Same thing with James. Love more so will be assisted. But another thing, too, is on a lot of those Love free throws that would have been assists, except he got fouled, so it wasn't scored that way. So I think their passing was a little bit better than it looked. But I do think it's always an issue a little bit with Cleveland that, you know, they're not moving the ball side to side unless it's a set out of bounds play, and especially late in games. And so they are relying on their guys to kick ass one-on-one, but that's going to work against all but the absolute best defenses, especially with the shooting they have around them. Now down the end, when they're playing both Shumpert and Thompson, because Smith was out with that hamstring, it maybe gets a little bit easier to stop them. Smith was tried to move around before the second half, and it looked like he was the one who's like, hey, hey, I can't go, which is a little bit different than the trainer saying that. So he clearly was in some discomfort. I think he's day to day. As of now, I would expect him to miss a couple of games if he was bothered that much. And they should be very conservative because they frankly don't need him in this series. And Shumpert, I thought, did do a really nice job on Paul George in what was an awesome third quarter for the Cavs as they went up 18 after the third quarter. And I definitely felt that in both of these games, especially this one, the first three quarters was more indicative of where these teams are than the fourth quarter, where, you know, Indiana was able to make a little bit of a run down the end.
I'm not trying deliberately to disappoint those who have a rooting interest for the two teams that lost tonight, but I think a lot at this point, you know, kind of the transition point in these two series about the idea that if you go down 2-0, sure, you lost a game on your home floor. You have to win 4 of 5, including at least one game on the other team's home floor, on the higher seed's home floor. And that's a big challenge. And even if, for those who think that the Pacers are a strong team, maybe this is a closer matchup than some anticipated, that is an extremely tall ask and one that I would say is exceedingly unlikely to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put it past the Cavs to just kind of mess around in these next two games and lose them both, and it'd kind of be like the Toronto series last year where then they come back and take care of business at home in game five. You know, this isn't a Cavs team where they're like, oh yeah, they just put the hammer down in game three, unless they're playing the Hawks, of course. So I can see that aspect of it for sure. And like you said, you know, there's that adage that, oh, the series doesn't start until, you know, the road team or the home team loses a game. Well, in this case, the series will have started when they're down 3-0, when they lose a game. And I think that's always just been a quote that's used to kind of gin up some enthusiasm for teams that are down 2-0. And I mean, you know, there's a reason why it's a 95% win expectancy or whatever it is when you're up 2-0. Now, of course, there's some selection bias in that because, number one, the team with home court is usually going to be way better. You know, if it's a 1-8 series or a 2-7 series like this, it's not like, you know, the team that goes up 2-0 is A, better already, and B, has already proven that it's better, or you wouldn't have won the first two games. So it's not like, you know, if the teams are even, there's less of a chance of coming back, but, you know, the teams are not even in this series as they are in most series that go up 2-0.
The point about it being a non-representative sample is extremely important here. I mean, you get a lot of those, you know, the teams that go up, not only in terms of the better seed, but think about just some of the best teams in the league and some of the talent disparity. While I openly opine for a system that is a little bit more preferable for top seeds, whether that be choosing opponents or top 16, whatever, they still generally have a pretty significant talent advantage. And I don't know exactly where you would draw those lines because it's hard to, you can't build even enough of a sample to make it, you know, of more even circumstances, but it's notable in that way too, because the teams that generally go up to nothing are really good teams.
Couple other notes before we move on here. I do think that the Pacers, when they're going with the traditional big with Love and Fry as the bigs for Cleveland, might even be better putting their center on Love. I think Fry is a more automatic wide open three-point shooter, and so you're better off playing a wing on him there. They'll use Fry in pick and pops more than they will Love as well, so you can get a switch there. And then Love also will try to post up against smaller guys, so if you put your center on him, maybe you're taking that away a little bit more. But of course, no easy answers when you have to deal with that. Monte Ellis, we mentioned, you know, in the open on the Twitter NBA show, this idea that, hey, you know, you can only play so many creators, especially if they can't shoot. I mean, Monte Ellis's usage rate was what, like 16% or something this year? He went 1 of 4 in 24 minutes, 0 of 1 from 3 at 2 points. And it's just like, the whole point of Monte Ellis is that he can create some shots for you. And he's just like not even really getting any touches to create those shots. And of course, they're not guarding him when he doesn't have the ball. So they're just this another example of how the theory of this team doesn't work. I mean, even if you believe that Monte can be this great scorer efficiently, which he can't, but even if you did think that, there just aren't enough shots to go around to even have him function in that role anyway.
Monte's usage rate this year was 16.7, almost identical to Anthony Mora, former teammate.
Paul George, his offensive game, I mean, we should probably talk about the way he drove to the basket. I was really impressed by what he was able to do in some ISOs up top. I especially liked getting him the ball kind of in that Dirk Nowitzki, Kevin Durant ISO area, 17, 18 feet from the basket. His dunk that he had was ridiculous. Of course, he just blew past Kyrie, who, didn't even bother to compete on that one either. It's fine if you're going to get overpowered and he shoots over you, just giving up a straight line drive to Paul George. Like, Kyrie should be quicker than him. And then Kevin Love actually took two very dangerous charge attempts, both of which were blocks. He was outside the restricted area, but he undercut George. George was lucky that he was able to land with his feet on either side of Love on that dunk attempt. And then Jeff Teague kind of messed up his wrist when Love undercut him as well, going for a charge. And just underscores again, I talked about this a lot in the Twitter NBA show, just my proposed fix to this charge issue is just push the restricted area out far enough that you'll never have a situation where someone is taking off and can still be undercut legally. If there is going to be a charge contact that's going to occur, let it occur before the guy gets in the air. Once he's in the air, you should not be able to take a charge, because guys are going to get hurt. It's just and Teague was lucky to escape without a severe wrist injury on that play, because he went flying.
I don't have much to add in that, just because we're in firm agreement, but I have a stat that just it bothered me forever, but considering its relevance in this game, the two most used lineups for the Indiana Pacers this year were their main four guys, Paul George, Jeff Teague, Miles Turner, Thaddeus Young, and either Monte Ellis or CJ Miles. Monte being the most used lineup and CJ's version being the second most used. The lineup with Monte, slight negative 0.2, so basically even. With CJ, plus 7.7 in 444 minutes.
Yeah, and recently they started bringing Ellis to start again. I mean, it's another one of those things that just doesn't make sense. Miles has never been quite the shooter you might hope for him to be, except in a few seasons, but certainly in these alignments, and Miles also has been really bad defensively in this series. Like, his ISOs, sure, against LeBron James, he's just been getting completely destroyed, and it doesn't make it easy when it's James playing in those shooting lineups, but especially with the second unit. But still, I mean, he's putting up no resistance, and his communication has been really bad in this series too. But he's still not any worse than Ellis is, and he at least can just stand in the corner and make a shot. I mean, that's what they need someone to do. And I don't know why it was that they went back to Ellis. I mean, Ellis had like a pretty good game in that double overtime game against Cleveland, and he played mostly in that double overtime, so maybe that was like all the excuse they needed to go back to him. But I agree with you. It is pretty frustrating, even if Miles has not played extremely well. He was 4-7 in this one in 16 minutes. So he actually is, when you consider the fact that Ellis can't, he's going to record scratch on most what would be open three-pointers. I mean, Miles actually is probably going to be able to get more shots than Ellis as well, just because Ellis, they're not just letting him run a pick and roll. And if you're not doing that with him, he has no way to generate shots. They just throw it to him on the perimeter, and then he just record scratches.
Anything else in this game? I feel like we kind of hit on all the big moments.
Yeah, no, I think that's all we need.
Oh, I have one.
Yes, okay.
So the game was, it was pretty well in hand with like 40 seconds to go, and the Cavs had the ball. I think they were up 5, and the Pacers had just had a nice defensive possession, and then Cleveland ran a beautiful out-of-bounds play to get, I believe it was Darren Williams,
it was Kyrie. Yeah, and the reason it worked was because Paul George failed to help on the back screen. It was a screen-the-screen interaction in which Kyrie set a screen for Korver going to the corner. They were all in a stack with four guys, and then LeBron hit a monster back screen on Teague. And Paul George, I know he's like really concerned about guarding LeBron, but you got to help on a back screen, or you're going to give up a layup. That's why back screens are pretty good plays to run. And especially because LeBron is not a great shooter, he did hit some pretty tough twos in the first half, but overall just not leaving him at all. I mean, he saw that Teague got obliterated, and but it was a great design by Lou again, so that was a nice play by him. As I think he's been able to get the better of McMillan in these late game situations, not that that was that close to begin with. So if you want to make your home look better, and you want to just make your life easier as well, blinds.com is a great way to do that. However, while blinds are awesome, installing them yourself is harder than a lot of of people want to admit. It's harder than my landlord wants to admit because he's got these ones, these like slat Venetian style blinds that he didn't even install correctly. He just put them in through some string and then like didn't even thread them through the holes that they're supposed to go through. They're just kind of laying there. And like if you tap the blind on the side, it'll like pop halfway out the other side. Like that's, you know, my landlord's kind of lazy, but you know, it shows that it's pretty difficult to install blinds. So blinds.com makes it really easy. They offer a free online design consultation if you need help getting started. You send in pictures of your home and you can get custom professional recommendations in return. They even will send you free samples. In fact, in my rental property, my tenant is doing that right now. I suggested that she pick out the blinds that she wanted and they sent her some free samples. She actually sent me a picture of them today. They look awesome. We're going to go for some cream colored roller blinds that both of us liked. So that process was extremely easy. And if you mismeasure or you pick out the wrong color, blinds.com will remake your blinds for free. For a limited time, you can get 20% off everything at blinds.com when you use that promo code CAPSPACE. Easy to remember because we talk about it all the time on the program. That's blinds.com, promo code CAPSPACE for 20% off everything. If you want faux wood, you want cellular shades, roller shades, and more. Blinds.com, promo code CAPSPACE, rules and restrictions apply. So with that epic Fizdale rant, which no doubt is going to get him fined, I decided to go and look and see whether he really had some beef or not. And the things that he talked about in particular were Kawhi Leonard, who obviously was fantastic, but went 19 for 19 from the foul line. And then he said, hey, Mike Conley can't get a call. What's up with that? He's this veteran. Maybe it's just because he doesn't complain that he doesn't get a call. Conley was 8 of 18 from the field, 4 of 8 from 3, 8 assists, 24 points. He was outstanding. And Leonard, 37 points, 9 of 14 from the field, and the aforementioned 19 of 19 from the line, though he did have 4 turnovers. So I went through all of Kawhi's shots and all of the fouls. And, you know, I think Fizdale did have a little bit of a point. There were probably 4 or 5 calls that were borderline. And, you know, I think he got the call on pretty much any of those. He did have a couple of plays where he went to the rim and there might have been a little contact. He didn't get the call, but those didn't look like fouls. So there was one play when he was just getting pressured up full court. He kind of got by his man a little bit. And then even though he was on the right side of the floor and the man was on his right side, he just ran closer to the sideline, which no one would ever do for any reason other than to try and draw a call. And he did. There were a couple of plays where he got Vince Carter in the air and drew the foul, but you know that's Carter's fault for jumping and putting it in that position. There was another play where he drove across the lane and kind of just went through Vince Carter's arm on a face-up drive. That one was, you know, clearly call-seeking behavior, a little questionable, but probably a foul as well. There was a play where, which wasn't a foul in his favor, but he cracked Jamichael Green in the face with an elbow, on a wing ISO on the left side. And then, while Green was stunned, went and just shot a wide open baseline jumper. And then there were a couple of plays where he attacked Marc Gasol in transition and, Gasol was called for the foul, which Gasol was not very happy about. One of them, Gasol or Kawhi just kind of tripped. And while Gasol was reaching in, they called the foul on Gasol, but the guy who called it was actually the baseline official and Kawhi's body was in between the official and the ball, so he couldn't see whether, you know, there was any contact with Kawhi's body or the ball. So that one was a little questionable. And then there's another one where Kawhi went into Gasol's body. Gasol came down with both of his hands. He wanted a jump ball and a foul was called again. You know, kind of borderline calls, but Kawhi really got the benefit of all those. So I could see it a little bit with Fizdale. And anytime an opposing player shoots 19 to 19 free throws, that is a concern. On the other hand, Conley, and one of Fizdale's big complaints, of course, was the Grizzlies took a bunch of shots in the paint and San Antonio didn't take that many in the paint. And, you know, Kawhi shot more free throws than their whole team. But he mentioned Conley specifically, and I saw 4 plays where Conley even plausibly could have gotten a foul. Conley drew 2 BS, you know, quote unquote shooting fouls, the field contact and throw it up plays. And then there was one drive late in the game with 3 minutes left on Patty Mills where Mills jumped forward into him, you know, ostensibly doing verticality, but kind of turned his body and was going forward. And that one should have been a foul. It wasn't called. And another one where Conley came right down the lane in the first half and was very aggrieved, thought he should have gotten a foul call. I couldn't really see whether Pau Gasol or David Lee made contact with him or not. It looked like Lee was trying to pull his hand away. I recognize that guilty hand in the cookie jar foul by Lee. So that that probably was one. So there might have been two fouls there where Conley should have gotten a call and he didn't, but he also, you know, got a couple of BS fouls himself with the call seeking behavior. And then, you know, really he didn't take hardly any other shots at the rim except for just wide open layups in transition, where there wasn't any kind of a foul call that reasonably could have been called. Finally, though, the irony here in Fizdale focusing on shots in the paint is that I went and looked at some of the league numbers comparing shots in the paint to number of free throws per game. And as a team, Memphis is 19th in field goal attempts in the restricted area on the season, and they are 12th in free throw attempts per game, which is a pretty large disparity in favor of basically foul calls that they are getting that you might say are kind of BS foul calls that aren't actually taking place in the restricted area, or, you know, being generated on those sorts of plays. Usually there's a pretty strong correlation. There's a few other differences. Teams like Golden State, for example, take more shots in the restricted area compared to less free throws because they're just so wide open on a lot of their shots, frankly, in the restricted area. They're not even close enough to get fouled. So I thought that was really interesting. And Conley, he takes 20% of his shots at the rim, and he has a very healthy 36% free throw rate, in part because he is, in fact, one of the best in the league at the field contact and throw up some bullshit and get the call on the perimeter play.
Beyond all that, you mentioned it in passing, but Fizdale also relied on something that you see coaches do, and I'm not critical of him for doing so, where he talked about, oh, Zach Randolph, he's one of the roughest, toughest guys in the league, and he wasn't getting calls. This is not that Zach Randolph. One of the ways that he has fallen off from an efficiency standpoint is that he's not getting to the line nearly as much as he was, and that's a big part of the reason why his offense wasn't at that same level, and part of the reason why I don't think either of us had him in consideration for a sixth man of the year.
Yeah, 49% true shooting from Randolph, in part because he only now takes less than 30% of his shots in the restricted area at this point. And Randolph did have some duck-ins that he could have made, but, you know, he had a sequence early in the third quarter. He's actually started the third quarter and missed a couple of layups that were some pretty easy ones. And overall, Memphis just did not shoot. They didn't make their shots in the paint. They were 10 out of 21 in the restricted area and 5 out of 14 in the paint non-restricted area. And, you know, a lot of those are post-ups too, which are, you know, more difficult shots. And the Spurs are also great at not fouling. Like, that's one of the things that they've been fantastic at for years and years and years. And guys like Gasol for a long time has been someone who, you know, when he was with the Lakers, his ability to stay on the floor for big minutes and avoid foul trouble. I mean, big men don't play like 38 minutes a game the way he used to play with the Lakers. And he was able to do that by avoiding foul trouble. Deadman, LaMarcus Aldridge, another guy who rarely gets in foul trouble. So those guys are good at using their length in the paint. And of course, Memphis doesn't have the ability to spread the floor. They were only 7 out of 27 on three-pointers, and of course 4 of those were made by Conley, so the 4 of 8. So the rest of the team was 3 out of 21 on three-pointers. And hey, guess what? Yeah, you're pounding the ball into the paint, but there's a bunch of dudes there who are really tall who are just going to jump straight up. It's not like you have these amazing finishers who are like putting these guys at a disadvantage. You know, you have guys like Gasol, Randolph, who are just kind of working into position, and you know, they got to make shots in the paint over length, and they don't have the explosion to do that efficiency. That's what their problem is. It's not that they're getting fouled and it's they're not getting the calls.
Agreed on all fronts. Also, you talked a little bit about Memphis's struggles from deep. Their bench missed all 8 of their three-point attempts, and even though Memphis does not rely on those guys for those kind of roles except Troy Daniels, which, you know, that's hopefully one of the things that he does well, you can't really survive that in the modern NBA, especially against a team as capable defensively as the Spurs.
I mean, so, you know, rough and tumble Zach Randolph, right? Like, he was 2 out of 4 in the restricted area in this game out of his 18 shots. And so, you know, if you assume he didn't get fouled on his makes, that's only 2 times, really, that he's right at the rim that you're talking about where there'd be a candidate for him to get fouled. And the reason he shot well is he was 6 of 9 on mid-rangers, and then he was a further 1 of 4, you know, on in the paint on kind of more post-up type of plays. So yeah, I mean, I realize they're shooting in the paint, and of course you know, if you're shooting from the paint outside the restricted area, those aren't really high foul areas either. I mean, 21 shots in the restricted area is actually really low as well. And they say that they took more than the Spurs. That's right, because the Spurs just don't take very many in the restricted area themselves either. So, yeah, I mean, they don't have anyone who's going to drive to the basket and score that way. They don't have, like, physical guys who are going through people in the post. Like, they're just, yeah, I don't know how you're going to expect to get the calls. Like, sometimes, and I thought Kawhi did have a friendly whistle in this one, but outside of that, you know, I didn't see much in this game where it was like, oh, Memphis isn't getting these calls. You know, there are three or four of them maybe, but it wasn't like that big of a disparity.
I don't think this is a big point, but I do want to mention it, that part of what Fizdale was using, he was trying to use juxtaposition to say, oh, Mike Conley doesn't go crazy to try to get calls. That argument rings incredibly hollow when you realize that the guy he's saying that about is Kawhi Leonard. Kawhi Leonard is not particularly demonstrative when he doesn't get calls. You know, he does have a little bit of an outsized reputation for being silent, but he isn't that guy. He isn't, you know, one of the members of various successful teams that kind of can browbeat the refs in terms of that. He might do that with his play and with his stature, but he doesn't do it in the way that Fizdale was complaining about.
And perhaps, you know, there's a lot of a mental game to this too. You know, he's sticking up for his best player, and frankly, although they did get back within 75-71 and played much better defense in the second half, they held San Antonio to 40 points in the second half after trailing 56-37 at halftime. And I do think they can carry over some of that defense, especially with Ennis doing more on Leonard. But with all that said, you know, I think he's just trying, if he can sell his own team on the idea that, hey, we got screwed by the refs, that's why we've been losing. I mean, obviously you need to make adjustments and continue to try to play better. But, you know, I mean, they've now lost six straight to the Spurs, all by double digits in the playoffs, granted, you know, without their main guys last year. So maybe they can get game three and make this a little bit of a series. I mean, that's what it's going to have to come down to now. That game three is on Thursday night on TNT. So there's a little bit of reason for optimism, because I think they really have started now to defend the Spurs a little bit better. Like, this, the second half looked like the Spurs team looked at times in that Oklahoma City series last year, where it was just Kawhi Leonard trying to go one-on-one, lots of ISO. Aldridge played 42 minutes. He was pretty ineffective, only had 11 points on 3 of 8 shooting. Gasol was able to hit some threes. That was important. Danny Green was 4 or 5 on threes. They were 9 out of 23 on threes, the Spurs, where they hit a great percentage, but, you know, don't get that many up, as we talked about. And so without Kawhi going one-on-one and LaMarcus not really doing that much of that, the Spurs team doesn't have a ton of impetus. Parker took a lot more shots. He was 3 of 5 on threes, but only 3 for 9 on twos. He fell off a little bit. It did have 15 points, but I still don't believe that he is going to be able to be an efficient engine of the offense when it counts. It's been 2-3 years now that he hasn't been able to do that. And then Danny Green only getting 5 shots. That's not enough for him, although he was 4 or 5 on his three-pointers. So I do think that there's a little bit of evidence here that while the Spurs do have some great individual talent, maybe the Grizz have started to find a little bit of something defensively now.
Well, I understand why this series is different because of the way Memphis plays their bigs. It is still notable that the backup swingmen, so I use that term for guys that are natural twos and threes, in this game, that was Manu Ginobili playing 18 minutes, Kyle Anderson playing 7 minutes, and that's it. No Jonathan Simmons, and no really kind of going in any other direction. Now, you can play two bigs against Memphis more than you can other teams, but if we're kind of going back to the idea of that Thunder series, we still don't know if Pop is going to go to those sorts of circumstances when challenged, and I don't think this is the time to fret about that.
Those circumstances being a smaller lineup.
Right. Well, I don't think this is the time to fret about it, but the more games we see kind of the marginalization of guys like Simmons and Kyle Anderson, not saying either one of them is, or even players.
Bertans, someone who could get some more shooting on the floor at the four as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's
not that he's like he's some a different stud,
type.
But.
Yeah, he's a different type of guy, but the concept is very similar. You know, the idea of getting floor spacing from a different spot. And I don't know, the Spurs are going to have such a massive adjustment if what we expect to see is the Rockets in the next round, of just in terms of not only play style, but just in terms of what Spurs lineups will make the most sense.
The other thing I would say about Memphis too, to finish up here, is Randolph starting in the second half. Ennis, who we thought should have been starting. I mean, I don't know what the thinking was behind. We're going to use former 10-day contract guy Wayne Seldon to start and guard Kawhi Leonard. That never really made a ton of sense to me. And, you know, he's committed plenty of fouls in this series and you know, just doesn't have the length to deal with Leonard. Not that Ennis is some stud either, but he's at least a little more experienced. And I thought did a better job. He's able to at least kind of hang with Kawhi physically. So maybe, you know, if they start those two guys in the next game, start Carter at the two, Ennis at the three. Marc Gasol really struggled in 39 minutes today. He was 4-for-15 from the field, 0-for-2 from three. I do think that they should try to see if they can get some more three-pointers for Gasol, get him in pick and pop a little bit more. But again, the firepower with Chandler Parsons and Tony Allen both out, the defensive firepower from Allen and forcing turnovers, that was another thing too. They did force 14 turnovers, which is good, and they're not turning it over at all. That helps a little bit, but I don't think they're reliably going to be able to turn over the Spurs team. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, it's looking kind of sweepy to me right now, but I'm sure they'll have a last gasp in game three. And I mean, the future is not looking that bright for this Grizzlies team with Parsons, a question mark, Tony Allen out for a while. Randolph is a free agent. So you really have to wonder what the next step is. They're capped out. So if this team just gets swept in the first round, you know, this is the beginning of the demise for this Grizzlies team that we've predicted for a long time, and they've held on for a long time, but it's not looking good for them. Maybe a little premature before game three, but we'll be seeing that demise if they do lose in game three. All right, why don't we move on to some news here, but first a message from our sponsor, SeatGeek. You can use the CapSpace code to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase with NBA playoff season upon us. SeatGeek is, in my opinion, the best place to buy and sell tickets. SeatGeek has two things about it that are better than some of the ways you used to buy tickets. One is they aggregate ticket buying sites together, so you don't have to go to a bunch of different sites worrying that you might have missed out on a deal. Now SeatGeek can bring a bunch of tickets together. And then the other part is their deal score technology, which ranks every ticket based on value. SeatGeek can look at seats that are priced $20 higher, but they're also a couple of rows ahead and maybe five seats to the left, and they'll tell you just what is the better bang for your buck based on their technology. So if you know generally where you want to sit, you already don't have to go to a bunch of sites. You save time that way. Now you can just pick out whatever they rank as the best value, and voila, you're done in 90 seconds, 2 minutes to buy your tickets with the faith that they've done a lot of the work for you. So the way to get started with SeatGeek, download the free SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab, click on add a promo code, and you put in that familiar code CapSpace, easy to remember because we talked about it on the program. And after you make your first SeatGeek purchase, SeatGeek will send you $20. That's the free SeatGeek app, promo code CapSpace. All right, it's news time. I think the place to start is the Rob Hennigan regime is over. Matt Lloyd, former scout for the Bulls, assistant GM, has been promoted to acting general manager. He will be considered for the full-time position. Scott Perry, assistant GM, also, they decided to move on from him. And I mean, it really, frankly, had gotten to the point where there wasn't much of a defense for Hennigan at all, given the 5 years that he'd had and the fact that the Magic were just going backwards, despite attempting to make win now moves.
The biggest part to me of their legacy is that Hennigan had a couple of nice moves. I would say, you know, getting what they did for Tobias, for not for Tobias Harris, sorry, getting Tobias Harris in the JJ Redick deal.
That was great. And then also, so was the Howard trade, actually was underrated. I mean, you think about who they got in that trade. They got a first rounder from Philly. They got a first rounder from Denver. I think they got Aaron Aflalo as well, who actually was good for them for a time, if overrated. They got
Aflalo got them Evan Fournier.
Yeah, that was a very solid deal. They got Mo Harkless. They got Nick Vucevic in that trade too. I mean, everyone was like, oh man, they traded Dwight Howard with a year on his contract. And also, like, they were able to trade Howard when he was damaged goods. I mean, he was never the same player again, despite a few flashes in Houston in the playoffs. So with all that said, he had some moments, but just so many absolute head scratchers. And the thing that really killed him, of course, was the inability, despite picking in the top five a lot, to get a difference maker. Mario Hezonja looking like one of the worst number five picks in history 2 years into his stint as a Magic. Aaron Gordon, solid pick for the number four, but and it's not like anyone picked right behind him has been much better. You know, Julius Randle Randle, Dante Exa, Marcus Smart, you know, aren't looking like much better prospects either. Even Emmanuel Mudiay, like Gordon, is probably looking like the best guy in that range, but also not a superstar, you know, someone who you can really hang your hat on as a pinnacle of the franchise. They drafted Oladipo in what was a weak draft, number two in 2013, and then they traded him away. I mean, and of course, the Ibaka trade was truly the death knell for Hennigan.
Two other big things that I think we have to discuss. One is I made a lot of hay out of it, so I feel like I have to bring it up, of the way that they gave up assets for nothing. Mo Harkless for a top 55 protected pick, Channing Frye for absolutely nothing, Tobias Harris for basically nothing. And those players had value. They had value if they had held on to them, numerous other things. And then a piece that in the postmortems on Hennigan, I think was really underappreciated, and this has happened before, the fact that they gave the Sixers back their own pick in that deal for Elfrid Payton. I don't remember exactly what the protection on that was, but that was, first of all, it was way too much to give up for what they did. But also,
yeah, it was,
you know,
moving
like,
up two spots in the draft from, and the Sixers got their guy Saric anyway. And Payton, also another guy who's been really up and down. It's still not clear that he is really a starting caliber player at point guards.
And committing the way that they did to him made it so that they couldn't really go after some of the other guys. I'm not saying that they passed on somebody who would have clearly been better or anything like that. Well, I mean, everybody's better than Hazonia.
Yeah, but, well, 2015, they probably would have looked a lot better than, you know, if they'd gone for someone other than Hazonia. That's certainly true.
Sure. And so you have all those things running together, and there isn't anything for him to really hang his hat on. It's be like the affirmative case for Hennigan is very, very hard. I mean, he did make a couple of good moves, and they got Evan Fournier to take a little bit less and a few other things, but there isn't much to show for it there. And another piece of this that, like, we talked about the Serge Ibaka trade, I think that keeping him on for this season really hurt them beyond the Ibaka trade. They gave long-term money to DJ Augustine, and that's just going to be a weight over them that is not worth giving up the assets it would take to get rid of him. And those are the types of things that you don't want, the moves that you don't want to have a GM fighting for their life to make.
Yeah, I mean, the Harris trade that opened up $50 million in cap space, Bismack Biyombo, $50 million in cap space for a bad team in a season when 27 of the 30 teams were going to have cap room. The results of that $50 million in cap space, Bismack Biyombo, re-signing Evan Fournier to a deal that we liked at the time, but, you know, looks average at best now. Fournier didn't have a great season. He was hoped to take a step forward this year. DJ Augustin, 1 year of Jeff Green at $15 million a year, and trading for the $6 million expiring contract to Jody Meeks, who was injured and barely played this year. That's what they got for Tobias Harris and all their cap space. And now they're really kind of capped out. I mean, they don't have a ton of flexibility right now. I'm projecting them going forward at about $15 million in space, which is still not very much. You know, that's like, maybe you could get a starter if you're lucky and you're a good destination there. And they've got, you know, extensions coming up for Payton and Gordon that they have as well. Lots of money committed in the long term. So really no flexibility going forward either. They do, of course, have what should be either a top five or six-ish pick, and maybe they'll get into the top three, depending on the lottery. But you mentioned the Ibaka trade. This is, again, you were the first to articulate this. You know, I've kind of mentioned this with coaches, but true just as much with GMs, if not more so, because, you know, they can really make more moves that'll hamstring the franchise going in the future. Once you start thinking about firing a guy and he's under pressure, you probably should just fire him, because he's going to do some dumb shit to try and save his job and win now and prove that, like, he's making progress, even though, you know, of course, that shouldn't be the standard. I mean, that's the owners allowing themselves to be bamboozled and saying, hey, we need to see progress right now. You know, their definition of progress is winning more games the next year, as opposed to, like, you know, getting good potential players onto the team. But them, and then, of course, the Lakers are the two examples of really just, like, trying to make all these win now moves to save their job. And if the person is doing a bad enough job that his job is in jeopardy to begin with, that's probably not who you want making the decision to try and win now, because they're not even going to do the right things to try and win now. Like, the Lakers and Magic tried to win now, and they're both no good this year anyway, and they killed their future. I mean, it's just the worst of all possible worlds.
Well, I feel like we have the a perfect transition from that to the third team that I think you could have included in that, who is now reaping the rewards of that, the New York Knicks. The Knicks spent a ton of money on Joakim Noah, which was a foolhardy decision, start to finish, and now they have less flexibility, and Phil Jackson, tactical genius in many ways as a coach, has made also the decision to not only just hurt the trade value of Carmelo Anthony, but from the reporting that's out there, both from I think the Daily News and from Woj, that he and the organization is alienating their best player.
Yeah, Porzingis skipped the exit meeting with Phil Jackson per multiple reports. Woj then wrote a long piece saying that he was really frustrated with the direction of the organization. I mean, the one difference, and there's actually one other team I wanted to segue to after this too, but the one difference is that Phil Jackson apparently had absolutely zero reason to be fearing for his job because James Dolan, and I will say this, we were saying how a mutual option is like kind of bullshit and like both sides never pick it up. Well, both sides did pick it up. Phil Jackson certainly had no reason not to. But part of the reason for that is the demise of his relationship with Jeannie Buss and the chance of greener pastures in LA for him. And then Dolan, you know, still by most accounts wants Phil Jackson as his shield. And Phil, of course, now is just trending completely in the wrong direction. He of course, I mean, it's amazing. We've said this before, but the idea that, all right, you know, Phil, you believe that the triangle works. I get it. I disagree with him. Pretty much anybody who follows modern basketball disagrees with him at this point. But for you to take over 3 years ago and then still after year three be saying, oh, well, you know, our problem is just that we haven't implemented the triangle well enough. Well, you're the GM. You're the president. Like, how is it that you haven't been able to even implement the style that you want? So you now have this insulation to say, well, we haven't implemented the style, but they've been incompetent in trying to implement the style 3 years. They haven't even really run the triangle the way Phil wants them to run it. So everyone could figure out that, like, you know, I mean, everyone has, but so Phil could figure out, hey, you know, we tried it and it just doesn't work.
The whole thing is just completely messed up. And I feel bad for a lot of the, you know, the other people involved in this. I mean, Porzingis is having his formative years dealt, like, kind of obscured by turmoil and by incompetence above him. And Melo, you know, his legacy is tied up in all this stuff that, you know, the team wasn't ever really able to build around him. Part of that is his own impatience in terms of helping gut the team when he got there. But another part of it is that once he got there, they made a series of bad moves as well. And so he hasn't gotten the teammates around him. And Phil bad-mouthing him now is
an insane decision. Yeah, I mean, Phil is basically saying, well, Melo would be better off somewhere else. And Michelle Roberts actually drafted a letter saying, hey, if players aren't allowed to complain about where they are and ask for trades, then management shouldn't be able to do it either. I suspect little will come of that letter other than just simply Michelle Roberts pleasing her, one of her more powerful constituents in Carmelo Anthony. But yeah, I mean, it's really incredible. And for Porzingis now, remember that the criteria to get a designated player max extension, now that's probably so far away that you shouldn't even be thinking about it if you're Porzingis. Like, how about you just, you know, make an all-star team first and then, you know, maintain that status for the next 5 years before you think about it. But this is how agents think, you know, and they want to think about this with their clients. Agents are always going to assume that their guy is going to be a huge superstar. And so you can only get the designated player max extension either from the team that drafted you or if you are traded in the first 4 years of your contract. And perhaps Porzingis is getting to the point where he might just say, hey, you know, this is the first test case of, I don't want to be here for the next 13 years of my career. If I want to get paid the most money, maybe I need to force a trade now. That's something we talked about potentially as an unintended consequence of being on a rookie deal. And you can only be traded on your rookie deal and still get that designated max extension in year 8 or 9. I mean, if I think actually that young players on bad teams should just ask for trades more often, you know, than they do. And so maybe this will be our first test case of that.
It very well could be. And I think we're way too early to get into a lot of the ramifications, but I think that a good representation will at least be considering that possibility at this point.
So we talked about another team where an embattled management team is now under fire, but is going to be retained. They picked up the option on Ryan McDonough's contract in Phoenix. And so he's kind of now where Kupchak and the option for one more year, that is. because he's kind of where Kupchak and Hennigan were last summer now, where Sarver is going to be, has been impatient. They've made it close to the playoffs a couple of times, started, you know, accelerated the rebuild, and then ended up actually retarding the rebuild as a result of that when they got to 48 wins in 2014. McDonough came in 2013. You know, they're supposed to tank. They just didn't succeed in tanking because they're actually really good that year unexpectedly. And now this year, of course, was the absolute ultra tank from the Suns. And that, of course, was done with the blessing of ownership. And so after a tank job like that, which was very coordinated, you have to imagine that he would get another year. And of course, he did. McDonough, decidedly mixed record, but also worth noting that Sarver has a record of doing this. His belief is that you don't extend guys' contracts before they get to the end of it. And, you know, that ended up in Steve Kerr leaving. It probably contributed to Mike D'Antoni leaving in 2008. Kerr, of course, leaving after one of the most feel-good seasons in Sun history in 2010. And they've never been the same since after he left. So now, I mean, I would imagine that McDonough is going to play things out again next year. We'll see whether there's going to be more of a win now edict again for the Suns or not, but, you know, not really a great situation. And of course, the common thread between all these is just that these are not some of the best owners in the league, I guess we should say, in Orlando, New York, and Phoenix.
And you could tie in, I mean, with where the Lakers were in terms of their overall structure and uncertainty last year. I mean, that was a factor in everything that happened there too. And with McDonough, it gets lost in the shuffle because of so many other things that are going on. They could be a significant player in this offseason. Not so much with their cap space, though I guess that is a possibility, but because they have Eric Bledsoe, and Eric Bledsoe could be one of the best players that is available on the trade market, and assuming many of the top end point guards return to their current homes, he could be one of the best point guards to change teams this year. And it's also possible that McDonough, with the win now edict, will keep him, but this is the summer where they need to figure a lot of this stuff out. And yeah, the draft lottery is going to help determine that, and McDonough has a decidedly mixed resume in terms of the draft. A lot of that will also depend on how people feel about Dragan Bender, and we also have to see, you know, Marquise Chris. I thought they did a good job moving up to get him. We'll see if it works out, just because I thought he was the guy before the drop off, and then they did a great job getting it Devin Booker where they did. I mean, that's a massive success, but we'll have to see moving forward. I thought they did a good job with him, but, you know, we're getting to the point with the guys that are on their, you know, that they're on their rookie contracts that are going to be sliding out of that. Alex Len is going to be a free agent this year. TJ Warren is going to be another year. That the rubber is starting to meet the road with them. And that's not a great time to have a GM that is kind of maybe not on his last legs, but that is in the strained part of the evaluation period. You would probably want somebody who is more in line with whatever your long-term vision is to be making those decisions.
Yeah, and I also think it's interesting that Earl Watson, his coaching style reminds me very much of Mark Jackson's, where, you know, he really tries to cater to his players. He's combative. You remember the fouling to prevent Russell Westbrook from getting the triple double, then going for fouling to get the stats, and then his comments afterwards about, hey, if you don't like it, like, do something about it, you know, other than beat us comfortably. Although, you know, I think he's like Mark Jackson without actually, you know, having coached a decent defense for a couple of years and having some modicum of success, and obviously without the talent that Warriors team has. But there are, you hear a few things about him really trying to manipulate. You see how hard he really plays for the favor of his players, really, I think, more than a lot of coaches probably should. You know, I think there should be a little bit more of a disconnect there. And, you know, with McDonough on an ending contract, Watson, I think his contract actually goes a year beyond McDonough's. You know, I could see him kind of going the, like, Jason Kidd route, the Jackson route, although he eventually lost his power struggle. You know, I could see a little bit of that dynamic developing in Phoenix. And, you know, I've heard some whispers, nothing confirmed, that's kind of the dynamic there a little bit.
I feel like the next place to go in terms of this is Christian Wood had a team option for this coming season that was declined. Charlotte doesn't really have much cap flexibility moving forward, so they presumably just decided they would rather have a roster spot than Christian Wood, which is defensible.
Yeah, Wood had some time to play, but they really decided that he couldn't be effective at all he's got a lot of physical talent. I'm sure he's going to play in summer league. He'll probably look good again in summer league, but you know, there's two franchises now that really have been exposed to him. And, you know, I think just he may not be there yet from kind of a work ethic standpoint, a professional standpoint yet. The next thing too is a report from Woj that GMs are complaining about the buyout process, essentially saying that because there's like a little bit of tampering and because teams know that guys are going to get bought out, now they can't trade these guys in the last years of their contracts. So it's like hurting the trade market. And in particular, it's hurting small markets. I mean, I was pretty incredulous at this report. I thought it was just total complaining and belly aching. And just like my response to that is just kind of grow up. Like these are some ridiculous complaints to me.
Agreed. I mean, the teams that have been hurt by it. I mean, you could argue that one of the biggest teams that was weakened by this was the Knicks, you know, Brandon Jennings. They just cut Brandon Jennings. The Mavericks with Deron Williams and Andrew Bogut, they're not exactly a small market team. I'm sure if you said that to Mark Cuban, he would argue it pretty vociferously. So it's teams that are not in the right place in their cycle, and often it's teams that make incorrect identifications of talent. You know, I'm not saying that necessarily with Dallas, but at certain moments, some of those buyout guys, it's just, you know, they ended up on your roster and it's not fair to have the expectation of getting that. And also part of the problem is the disparity between the value of assets that are available to teams. You know, maybe we've talked about the idea of a 1.5 round pick, but it's also that the top half of the second round is valuable and the bottom half of the second round is almost worthless. So yeah, maybe they could get a worthless pick for those guys, but are you going to bellyache
about that? Good teams that are trading for this guy, right? Good teams have bad second round picks, and these guys aren't worth first. Like, that's the thing. Like, these guys aren't worth anything. Like, they're not good and they usually have huge salaries. So now you have to send back salary. None of these teams want to take on long-term salary, and anybody who's making much money on a good team already is probably going to be contributing, so they're not going to want to give him up. They're not going to want to give up assets. I mean, look at Bogut to the Cavs. Like, what were they supposed to trade for him?
And that's exactly where I was going to go with this. Is the league has made it very difficult in the modern era, and there are justifications for this, for teams that are expensive to add talent. You know, the hard cap in the Clippers case, the idea of adding guys. And so Cleveland with Bogut is a good example of it. There are numerous other ones where it's like, yeah, okay. So if that's where he wanted to go, the only way it was going to happen was through a buyout. So even if you change the system around, yeah, maybe they're going to have it go that way. But also it'd be interesting to see if agents ever wanted to put it in there, because also there's just the pragmatism of this, that it's hard to create a system that does what these GMs purportedly want to do.
Here's the thing. If your guy's good, you can get some assets for him. Serge Ibaka is on an expiring contract. He's making $12 million a year. Oh, hey, guess what? They got some assets for him because he actually can play and he's worth his salary. Joe Johnson was making $20 million a year. Nobody's going to trade for Joe Johnson making $20 million a year in the last year of his contract, especially when he'd been really bad for most of that year with the Nets. As he was just kind of beaten down on a horrendous team. Like, you know, Miami and the Cavs were the one that was interested in Joe Johnson last year. Those guys, they didn't have matching salary of $20 million to trade. And the Cavs don't want to trade back $15 million because now that's another like $25 million in luxury tax that they have to pay if they take on more salary. You know, these guys aren't worth anything. That's why you're not getting any assets for them. You know, like, there's supposed to be some bidding war for Andrew Bogut, who played like 15 games this year. Are you kidding me?
I like that this still makes you angry after we've talked about it offline like three different times.
Well, and it's the small markets thing too that really kills me, because there have been so many what I think generally are bad policies that were enacted by praying to the altar of small markets. It's like in politics, how everyone's like, oh yeah, we got to help small business. We got to help small business. Like, that's the most important thing. Like, it's some holy grail to have a small business instead of a larger business. Like, it's the same thing with small markets, and all of these things that are supposedly supposed to help small markets, either they fix a problem that has nothing to do with market size, like this one. I mean, it's just whether you're a good team or a bad team, that's what determines it. Whether guys you're going to buy someone out or whether you're going to receive a buyout candidate. You know, the luxury tax was supposed to help small markets, but now the only teams that can afford it are big markets. So it actually, or rich owners. So it actually has hurt small markets, the stricter luxury tax in the 2011 CBA. It's very hypocritical.
Well, and the other huge one that we have to mention here is the extension system. The extension system was jacked up in the 2011 CBA because they were all mad about LeBron and all these other things. And you know who lost out? The the biggest team in that CBA? The Oklahoma City Thunder, one of the smallest markets in the entire league. And it was another, you could call it an unintended consequence, but I don't think it was an unintended consequence at all.
Well, I wouldn't say, I mean, the lack of sign and trades was due to LeBron. I think the extensions.
Well, no, the sign and trade was, the sign and trade was Melo. Oh, no, that was the extend and trade was Melo. Sorry.
Yeah. But the extensions was more the Richard Hamilton, Steven Jackson extensions, like protect owners from themselves, protect players from like agitating for extensions when they're eligible. So that I think was more the issue there.
Right.
More protect stupid owners than small markets. All right. I'm getting worked up here for 1:37 a.m. I should probably calm down a little bit.
Well, we can get to some Sixers news.
Yeah, go for it.
So there are two different things with the Sixers. We'll do the dessert first. Ben Simmons was cleared for 5-on-5 work, so he's not going to play in summer league, but he had a clean scan, I think is what I heard, on his foot. And then on the negative side, according to the Sixers PR staff, Robert Covington will undergo surgery in the coming days.
Yeah, that's on that torn meniscus that was diagnosed a couple weeks before the season ended. Another interesting stuff. This is something that you, of course, are very dialed in on with Warriors salary issues. Tim Kawakami wrote a piece today discussing the Warriors' future from a cap perspective, and he seemed quite confident that they were going to work it out and keep this team together. He reported he's heard that the Andre Iguodala deal is basically done except for the years, which is a little interesting, but even for that deal to be done, in the first year with a certain yearly salary that would be commensurate with what Iguodala wants, that would imply that there's an assumption that KD will not take his max salary. That'll be about a $3 million haircut this year, but would enable him to then sign a four-year max deal next year. And of course, keep Andre Iguodala and perhaps Sean Livingston, although I think he's more likely to move on. So that's encouraging for Warriors fans. We'll see whether that actually all ends up working out. You know, the best laid plans can go awry depending on what happens, but certainly I think that this marriage, despite some small bumps in the road with the Curry performance on Christmas, KD's 2-for-10 performance in Sacramento in January, with Durant back looking good in that game one, the Warriors looking like by far the best team in basketball. It's been about as good of a marriage as any of them had a right to hope for. They completely fulfilled expectations from a performance standpoint. And, no reason to think that this group is going to get broken up, especially after all the crap KD had to go through to get here.
I actually recorded the Locked On Warriors episode that will be for the same day as this Dunked On, was partially on that Iguodala possibility. And I went through some of the options in terms of Durant with and without, and something I floated in there, I don't want us to use this as a point of emphasis for this podcast. I also talked about Ian Clark, which I think is a fascinating situation. But with Iguodala, the possibility that he, if need be, would do something more in the Manu Ginobili realm. And so what Manu did was he took that pay cut for 1 year to facilitate them bringing in LaMarcus Aldridge and then got a pay raise this year, the subsequent year. You have to be very careful about those sorts of things. You don't want a Joe Smith situation. But that possibility is just kind of there, considering the pre-existing relationships between all the parties. I don't expect that outcome, but I wanted to broach the possibility.
Yeah, because if they re-sign him to a one-year deal, then they would still have full bird rights on him, with him having been on the team 5 years, so they could pay him whatever they wanted next year. All right, I think that'll do it for today. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget about our sponsors, Blinds.com. Use that cap space code to get 20% off and $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via rebate using that cap space code as well. Don't forget about the Twitter NBA show. I was solo today. Danny will be joining me tomorrow. We got three excellent games on tap, starting at 4 Eastern.
4 Pacific.
Yes.
And also, a great Eastern wrinkle for tomorrow is it's the three games where the home team lost game one. So there are a lot of panic meters, a lot of different stories going into Tuesday's games.
Yeah, we'll see how we'll do. We'll probably just start off early on and then switch back and forth with the early games, see which game looks like the best. And then, we've got the late game. You want to just give us the schedule real quick before we sign off?
Milwaukee, Toronto is at 7 Eastern. Chicago at Boston is at 8 Eastern. and Utah Clippers is at 10:30 Eastern.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. And also, actually, I tried something today, which I think we'll do again tomorrow, which was we heard a lot of people who are streaming. Basically, whenever you try and stream a game, it's 90 seconds or so behind. And so normally we'd just been doing it as fast as we could on our TV, and that was a little bit easier for people who were trying to sync up watching on TV, but it made it impossible for the people who are international listeners or watchers, or, you know, people on streaming services. And we figured if you're watching on TV, you can always just delay it for 90 seconds. That's a bit of an inconvenience, but compare that to just not being able to watch at all, because we're actually ahead of the action for the streamers. So we tried to cater to the streamers this time, got some positive commentary in the comments. So I think we'll do that in the future, see kind of what that does to our numbers. And if you want to weigh in on that a little bit, you know, I definitely would suspect, Danny, would you agree with me that probably a greater percentage of our listeners stream than just, you know, on average, or watchers of the Tour NBA show?
I would say so. But also, I think the people who enjoy listening to us would also be willing to have that delay, because all you really have to do is record the game and then just queue it up. And since we are pretty frequent about our timestamps, it's very easy to sync it up that way. And you can basically get the desired experience without the volatility that we have that is a part of the process, just because however you get to watch the game, the timing on it's going to be different. And also the timing can be different in terms of a Periscope. I've heard that mobile and desktop have slightly different timing, and that's not a problem if everybody is just kind of controlling their feed a little bit.
Yeah. All right. But again, we love the feedback on the Twitter NBA show. Absolutely. It's an experiment. We're trying to make it better. And we appreciate you guys watching and also telling us how to make it better. So thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for watching. Talk to y'all tomorrow. Till then.